I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Hey, y'all. This is Sam's Aunt Betty. This week on the show, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith and one of the hosts of NPR's All Things Considered, Ari Shapiro. All right, let's start the show.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
I'm always judging her performance every week.
That was really great.
Betty, she's really becoming a pro at this.
She wants a contract. She told me as much. Anyway, hey, y'all, this is NPR. Sam Sanders here. It's been a minute. Each week, we start with a different song. I'll explain this song in a second. But first, as Aunt Betty said, two all-stars here today. So happy to have you both here. Ari Shapiro from a little show called All Things Considered.
Hey, Sam.
Hi. Thanks for being here. Tamara Keith, my old friend, still friend.
Yes.
From the NPR Politics team and the NPR Politics podcast. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
It's nice to be in a booth with you again. Takes me back.
This is the booth.
Thank you guys for being here. Have you guessed this song yet?
It sounds like Janet Jackson.
Yeah, it sounds like Janet Jackson. Yeah.
Which Janet Jackson song can you guess?
Oh, give me a minute.
It's from the album Control. The Pleasure Principle.
Oh.
The Pleasure Principle.
I'm just happy that I knew it was Janet Jackson.
Yes! Kudos to you. Kudos. I'm playing this song for a reason. Janet Jackson's not so much in the news this week, but Justin Timberlake
is. Oh, right. Halftime show.
Yes, he's going to be doing the halftime show for the Super Bowl next year. This is several years after 2004, when Janet and Justin were performing, and we all saw that now infamous wardrobe malfunction.
It was early in the days of DVRs.
And you could freeze frame.
We were like, oh my gosh, we're at a friend's house who has a DVR. And we like went back frame by frame by frame. And we're like, oh yes, we did see something.
And I bring up Janet and I play Janet because I was always kind of upset with the way that Justin Timberlake kind of got off scot-free. Mm-hmm. And Janet's career really never recovered.
Oh, I don't think that's the reason her career never really recovered.
Ooh,
you do? Really?
That's part of it.
I feel like she had a career arc that was a hugely successful career arc.
Totally.
I mean, she was the biggest she was in the late 80s, early 90s.
I wanted
and
her to be big
this was
forever.
2004.
I think I'm a little too much of a Janet fan because I wanted her to be the biggest thing all the time. You know, Timberlake said of the way that he and Janet were treated in the aftermath, he said, quote, I probably got 10% of the blame, and that says something about society. I think that America's harsher on women. You don't say, Justin.
You think?
You don't say. But, Janet, we love you. Justin, we love you. I'm looking forward to the halftime show.
Absolutely. Also, not to get too heavy too soon, but I do think all the news about Weinstein and the other sexual harassers ties into the gender divide in ways that go far broader and deeper than just accusations of sexual abuse and harassment, that you don't believe women unless a large group of them come out and say something loudly in force.
And they have to be on the record and in public and then we'll see. But typically, their careers are the ones that suffer more.
Oh, yeah. And when there's ever a conversation to be had around interactions between men and women, it seems like women are forced not just to carry the conversation, but to have a higher burden of proof and to take more of the responsibility for whatever happens. We digress.
Yeah.
All right, we're here to discuss what happened this week, the latest on this feud between the GOP and the president. We'll talk about Indonesia because Ari was just there, huh?
I was, and I've got a whole bunch of stories all queued up that are going to air in the days ahead.
I love it. We'll talk about that, yeah. And we'll call a listener somewhere out in the country. Let's just get started. I want us each to describe this week of news in only three words. You all have prepared. Tam, you're up first.
Just say no. So
why those words?
Well, as I was listening to President Trump on Thursday give this big speech about the opioid epidemic, he started talking about his brother, who was an alcoholic, whose life was destroyed by alcoholism.
And died because of it, right?
Yeah, and he was talking about how his brother told him, don't drink, don't smoke. And President Trump says that he has never had alcohol and has never smoked cigarettes. And then he said, so I was thinking maybe we should have this big ad campaign to tell kids not to use drugs.
We're going to bring back DARE?
And I thought,
I loved my t-shirt.
Nancy Reagan t-shirt. Is shouting from the grave.
Just say no.
Just say no.
How did that read to the crowd? Because I'm sure a lot of families would say, it's not that easy.
And the medical community would say it's not that easy. And
a huge percentage of people who are addicted to opioids started out taking a prescription that was given to them by their doctor.
Right. Like something like 40%. Only 40% of those people who are addicted to opioids, heroin, fentanyl, or OxyContin, or those types, got to it through recreational use.
So 60% started with a prescription. Yeah.
Or some other pathway to addiction. Yeah.
Outline for us, Tam, briefly, what Trump announced. He made a declaration about the opioid crisis, right?
Right. So for about 2 months, he's been saying that he is going to declare a national emergency as relates to the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
What he ultimately ended up doing was declaring an emergency under the Public Health Act, public health emergency, which is a little bit different. If he had declared a different kind of emergency, it might have meant all kinds of disaster funding, just like with, you know, a hurricane or something like that.
And would have come through FEMA, right?
Would have come through. But instead, it's a public health emergency. The White House argues this is a more reasonable, better, ultimately long-term, better way to handle this. But in the short term, it means there is no new money.
It allows some money to be moved around in different ways.
Yeah, within existing grant programs.
But no new money.
No new money.
And also, telemedicine has something to do with this?
Yes.
So telemedicine, what do we mean by that?
That basically means that someone can see a doctor without going into the doctor's office. They could see a doctor in a big city while they're sitting in a more rural area at home. So basically, by declaring this emergency, it allows some waivers of some rules and would allow more people access to telemedicine services.
Which actually does seem important since this is such a problem in rural communities where there are fewer doctors.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a doctor shortage, and the telemedicine element of this is the public health community really believes that for most people, the best way to treat a substance use disorder is through medication-assisted treatment for people with opioids.
Yeah.
So methadone, buprenorphine, some of these other drugs that reduce the craving and allow you to return to society.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get those drugs under the current rules, so telemedicine would make that easier.
Yeah. How prepared is the Trump administration to really go full force against the opioid crisis when right now they lack a Secretary of Health and Human Services? We all know that Tom Price is out of there. Is there a drug czar even?
Nope. Actually, the nominee for drug czar last week had to withdraw because there was this 60 Minutes story about how he had pushed through legislation. He's a congressman. He pushed through legislation that drug distributors wanted that actually made it harder for the DEA to crack down on opioids.
Man. That was an incredible investigation.
Yeah.
And reading it, I thought to myself, I know these lawmakers don't see themselves as complicit in overdose deaths.
We all were, though.
But a lot of people reading that story are going to say these lawmakers have blood on their
hands. And President Obama signed that bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the bill passed through unanimous consent. There were no no votes.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. What I was thinking this morning is why hasn't there been just a big bipartisan bill on massive funding to fight this? It seems as if Democrats and Republicans admit this is a big problem that needs resources to fight it, right?
So 2 years ago, there was a big bill.
Huh.
And there was a lot of money. It turns out it's not enough. So the Trump administration, as the Obama administration before it, has been administering these grants that were part of that program. But it is believed by many people in Congress on both sides of the aisle, this really is not a partisan issue.
Yeah.
Like, you take all the things that the Trump administration and Congress could work on, there is really bipartisan consensus on this.
Yeah.
And they need a lot more money. They're talking about not hundreds of millions of dollars, but billions of dollars that ultimately will be needed. And that this is a long-term problem.
All right, Ari, what are your three words?
My three words are Comey's on Twitter. Which might sound like a small detail and might sound like something that we already knew or at least suspected.
And this is Comey, James
this
Comey.
This is James Comey, former head of the FBI, who was fired by President Trump, who back in March, he revealed at this panel discussion that he lurked on Twitter under a pseudonym. And this enterprising reporter named Ashley Feinberg, who was at Gizmodo then, now she's at Huffington Post, figured out what his Twitter account was, and it was called Reinhard Niebuhr, I think. It was
like
an obscure philosopher, and she's sort of like triangulated by who he was following and who was following him, going through Instagram and Twitter. And everybody suspected, but nobody knew for a fact. And then suddenly, this week, that Twitter account started tweeting images
from Iowa
with these little, like, fall landscapes.
He was, like, in the middle of a road wearing sweatpants and sneakers.
Well, so finally, that was the last one, was, like, an image of James Comey from behind this tall...
No, it wasn't his face.
No. And then there were all of these, like, you know, crazy speculative tweets. Of, oh, he's in Iowa. Maybe he's going to run for office because the Iowa caucuses. Uh-huh. And then somebody pointed out that he was wearing... running shoes, and they were like, he's running. He's literally running. So it's so easy to imagine the drama in Washington as some kind of TV soap opera where you thought the Comey character's dramatic arc had ended months ago.
Bring him back.
The character is back. And of course, Comey was leading the investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia after he was fired. The Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller to investigate this quasi-independently. So all of the Russia stuff has been unfolding partly as a consequence of Comey's firing. And at the same time, this thing about Comey's on Twitter, to me, points to a larger truth of where we sit right now. Just this week, Twitter said that Sputnik and RT, which are sort of Russian propaganda news organizations, are going to be banned from Twitter. At the same time, Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker and our President Trump are having a fight on Twitter. Twitter has become, and this is not a new thing, but it was a thing that was really illuminated starkly this week, a forum where policy and politics plays out in real time, and you have to be there.
You have to.
And if you're not, like RT and Sputnik, there are going to be consequences. Mm-hmm. And taking a step even further back, to me, this points out the extent to which companies like Twitter and Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon are shaping our lives.
And because of that, some say have a really bigger responsibility to monitor what goes on these platforms.
And the people who are making the decisions for these huge tech companies are not elected.
Yeah.
And they have at least as much power as many elected officials.
I will say, I mean, like, also with this Comey stuff, seeing him resurface reminds me yet again that we'll actually never stop discussing the 2016 election. We never will.
The whole dossier news this week.
There were like more headlines about Hillary Clinton this week and a 2010 uranium deal.
It's never going away.
And the dossier, we should explain, was a sort of opposition research paper that this week it came out was funded in part by people in the Clinton orbit. And so, it's as though she is still running.
I have three words. They are, we're all aggrieved.
Hmm.
Which I think has been the state of the country for a while now. But also, this week it came into sharp relief for me because NPR released a new study on Americans' views of race and discrimination. And the study basically found that literally every racial group says that they feel racial discrimination.
Including white people, although not a majority of white people had personally experienced discrimination.
Yes, so a majority of white respondents said that discrimination against whites is a thing, but when pressed to name examples of it in their own lives, a much smaller number could point to specific examples. The study's worth checking out just to really get a view of, like, how race, which is kind of a part of everything, our politics, et cetera, how fractured we are on this issue right now, as we are on so many other issues. But there were some really interesting plot points that stood out for me, particularly how your income affects your views on race and discrimination. The lower income the white respondents, the more prone they were to say that they experience discrimination because they're white. But the higher income the black respondents, the more they saw discrimination. It was like this inverse.
Wow.
Really?
Yes.
See, one of the reasons that racism is so difficult to tackle and so insidious is that in so many cases, you don't know whether someone is treating you a certain way because of your race or because they woke up on the wrong side of the bed that morning.
Yes.
And you're left to guess and infer and think,
drive
am
you crazy.
I crazy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, Gene Demby over at our Code Switch team, it's a unit that covers race, ethnicity, and culture here at NPR, he said that perhaps the reason that higher income blacks see this more is because they're around more white people.
Hmm.
The lower income you are as a black person, the more likely you are to be isolated with other black people, right? The whole thing is worth the read. Gene has a nice write-up. Don Gagne has a piece about it all as well. It is fascinating.
Yeah, and on the radio, I guess we're going to hear a whole series of stories looking at this from specific perspectives of specific demographic groups, and some of them have already started to air. They've been really interesting.
They have been. We're all aggrieved. All right, time for a quick break. Coming up, more news of the week. And later, we'll hear our listeners tell us the best things of their week. You are listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders, and we'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Discover. The traditional first anniversary gift is paper. Most couples aren't gifting each other stationery, but Discover is following this anniversary tradition for its new card members. At the end of your first year, Discover will match all the cash back you earned dollar for dollar. No caps and no catch. That's a paper anniversary gift in the form of a cash back bonus. Learn more at discover.com/match. Cash back match offer only for new card members. Limitations apply.
We are back. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, the show where we catch up on the week that was. I'm Sam Sanders with two all-stars, host of All Things Considered, Ari Shapiro, and NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. You guys, quick question, yes or no. Amazon has a new service out called Amazon Key. You pay $2.50, and Amazon installs a remote-operated lock in your house.
$2.50?
$250.
Okay.
But once you have this lock thing in there, it allows Amazon to unlock your door when you're not there.
Oh, no, I saw this episode of Mr.
Folks,
Robot. That's
so,
not
so they can deliver stuff.
House.
Why no. not? It'd be easy, you know.
Did you see this episode of Mr. Robot where
no.
the whole smart house started going crazy? That's not going to be my house.
Yeah.
So you're a Nah. What about you?
I'm a Nah. I've installed a Nest, and I have an Alexa, and that's probably I've already let the computers in way too much.
I like unplugged my Alexa for a week just because I was like, you're getting on my nerves right now. I don't trust you.
Time out, Alexa.
Time out, Alexa. I did that. I did. All right. Now it's time for a segment that we call Long Distance. It's where we call a listener somewhere in the world and talk to them about the news in their neck of the woods. Today on the line, we have a listener from Texas, Aaron Dutka. Aaron, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
All right. You're on the line with two friends of mine, Ari and Tam.
Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
So what do you do out there in Houston?
I'm a teacher.
What do you teach?
I teach reading intervention for kindergarten through fifth grade.
Oh,
so
wow.
all the kids that are struggling with reading, I pull them and work with them in small groups trying to help, you know, get them where they need to be.
What's your favorite kid's book?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I think Secret Garden. The Secret Garden is one of my favorites.
That's a good one, yeah. So we're calling you this week to talk about how a lot of Americans like yourself are recovering in the aftermath of some major hurricanes and wildfires across the country. Houston was hit hard by Hurricane Harvey recently. How did it affect you?
I had 61 inches of water in my house.
Whoa.
After Hurricane Harvey.
That's like 6 feet of water.
Yes.
Were you able to take valuables and heirlooms and, you know, photographs and things like that with you?
So we put things on countertops, expecting that to be high enough.
But that wasn't high enough.
It wasn't high enough. So we literally just had what we had in our bags when we left.
Wow.
Or things that were up in higher cabinets and things like that.
And so since the storm hit and your home flooded massively, you've been, what, crashing with friends or what?
Yes, with a friend, a coworker, actually.
Okay.
So,
wow.
Yeah, we're living here, and another couple that also flooded is living in the same house as well in another extra room.
Whoa.
It's you and your boyfriend and two mm-hmm. beagles, if I heard correctly.
Yes.
All right.
Two loud beagles.
And so it's all of y'all there with two other couples in this house.
Yes.
Now, you have been dealing with FEMA, correct? You've applied for what kind of assistance?
I was just trying to hopefully get some housing assistance so we could maybe rent something
mm-hmm.
temporarily, maybe even a long-term hotel, something like that.
Mm-hmm. How'd that go?
So, well, when I initially applied, a couple days later looked and it said I had been denied. And had no idea why. Spent a lot of time trying to get answers from them.
Did you get answers?
Well, initially I went to one of the locations that they set up, waited a couple of hours, finally got to talk to somebody.
But you mean like waited in line a couple hours?
Yeah.
Oh.
And when I finally got to talk to somebody, they weren't able to pull up my application to look at it to tell me why I had got denied.
Oh, my goodness.
He said, here's the phone number. And he actually said that FEMA was answering calls 24 hours and it was best to call like after midnight.
Oh, my God.
So I stayed up on a weekday, you know, work day until after midnight to try to call. And lo and behold, they weren't actually taking calls that late at night.
No.
Yeah.
Through all this drama, from what you've told us, you did get an inspector to come out at some point, right?
Yes. Yes. I finally was able to get through on the phone. They fixed the problem because I had apparently checked that it was not my primary residence. I don't remember ever saying it was a secondary residence.
Do you have a secondary residence?
Go with it. No, not at all.
Okay. So you get the inspector out there finally. What happens then?
The paperwork went through, I guess, whatever the inspector did. Couple weeks later, I go and check on my application, and it said I was denied because I have flood insurance.
Oh. So you've appealed that denial, right?
Yes, I had to get a denial letter. But they know that flood insurance doesn't cover housing assistance because the government is the one that provides the flood insurance.
So you have no aid right now?
Yes, I filed my appeal October 6th. And still haven't heard anything.
Well, I will say I did reach out to FEMA in advance of our call because I wanted to just see what they're saying about all of this. And I spoke with a spokesperson who's based in Houston. Her name is Pam Salsby. And I said, listen, we're talking to listeners that are dealing with crazy wait times, technical errors. They're just desperate and stuck, and they feel like FEMA's not really helping them out right now. And she basically said, I get it. FEMA gets it. We know that this is a crazy time for people, and we're really kind of under the gun because they're dealing with, what, three hurricanes and the aftermath of all those wildfires. They've had over some 4 million calls in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I believe it.
Have you come up with a plan?
We know that we can stay here probably through the beginning of December because at that point, the person whose house it is, my coworker, her daughter's graduating. And we'll be moving back. So
they're going to take your bedroom.
Okay. So at that point, we have to figure something out. So that's kind of, we're in a kind of bind as to what we're going to do.
Yeah. What are you going to do this weekend to de-stress?
I'm actually going camping this weekend. We're getting ready to pack up. And there's actually a Renaissance festival that happens north of Houston.
Okay.
So we like to go and people watch.
Have a turkey leg.
Yes, definitely. Lots of meat on a stick. and then we just like to stumble back to the campground and do that. So it'll be a nice little break from everything.
Yeah. Well, have a good weekend. Enjoy the Ren Fair, and we're rooting for you.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
One more thing about FEMA. You know, I was talking to this spokesperson and also two private contractors who used to work with FEMA. And one thing they all made really clear to me is that after a disaster like Harvey, people have outsized expectations of what FEMA should do or can do. And they're never going to be the agency that does the whole recovery for you.
And there's a real debate right now over whether something like flood insurance, which encourages people to rebuild in a
flood
place
zones
that has flooded in the past, is really the most helpful thing for figuring out what we're going to do with bigger storms, hotter wildfires, disasters that, because of climate change, are going to be becoming more intense in the years ahead.
Yeah. Just to close, I want to say that if you're in Texas, FEMA has extended their deadline for individuals to apply for assistance to November 24th. In Florida, that deadline is November 9th. In Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, that deadline is November 19th. Listeners, we want to talk to you for this segment. If you want us to give you a call and hear about anything in your neck of the woods, just drop me a note. Tell me what's going on. SamSanders@NPR.org. You are listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, the show where we catch up on the week that was. I'm Sam Sanders here with Ari Shapiro from NPR's All Things Considered and my former politics podcast co-host, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith.
Hello.
It's like old times.
It is. Do you want to talk about politics? Oh, wait, we're about to do that.
Yeah. It is time for our main story of the week, which is, drumroll please, politics. So last week on the show, I talked with some folks about the growing civil war between President Trump and the GOP. This week, I want to talk more about that civil war because it seems as if a general has been anointed. Jeff Flake, senator from Arizona.
Interesting idea.
Is he a general in this war? Or is he he's leaving the battlefield, actually.
Look, I mean, he wanted to run for re-election, and the poll numbers were saying he wouldn't win his primary.
Yeah.
Primary.
And let's just catch our audience up. This Tuesday, Jeff Flake, Arizona Republican senator, he gave this 17-minute speech on the Senate floor where he did not just announce that he wouldn't run in 2018. He said that he had to free himself from considerations that consume too much bandwidth and would cause him to compromise too many principles. It was an anti-Trump kind of rant that seemed to be in some ways unprecedented.
I think rant is the wrong word.
It was very carefully thought out.
It was measured. It was emotional. But I have come to think of a lot of these people who are speaking out as retiring.
because R meaning Republican.
Republican.
Yeah. Retiring Republicans.
Retiring.
Because Bob Corker, senator from Tennessee, he has been going after Trump, but he's also not going to run for re-election.
In a way, these are alarm bells ringing at the same time that the people ringing those alarms are admitting defeat, that Trump remains president, mm-hmm. the Republican Party remains supportive of his agenda. Even Corker and Flake have, on the whole, voted for the bills that President Trump has supported.
And the same day of Flake's speech, Flake later voted for a GOP-supported measure to make it a little bit harder for consumers to go after big banks.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't about policy. This is about norms. This is about temperament. This is about defending the First Amendment and
attacking
defending
Gold Star families, yes. supporting conspiracy theories.
These are the complaints that Corker and Flake and some of these other Republicans have. It's not about the tax legislation or about health care. They've been party line votes on that.
Yeah.
So I was listening to Rush Limbaugh's show earlier this week while I was driving somewhere, and he was talking about Corker. It was the morning before the Flake speech. So Flake wasn't in his discussion, but he was saying, look at Bob Corker. All of these Republicans who are elected were prepared for Hillary Clinton to win. They were prepared to continue being the same Republican Party in opposition to Hillary Clinton. But then Donald Trump won, and he won by saying, I don't believe in your free trade. I don't believe in your nice, polite conventions.
He's even wishy-washy on the idea of smaller government, because in some ways he supported infrastructure measures.
Mm-hmm. He's cool with growing the deficit.
He said that he wants bigger health care at certain points.
So he is not an establishment Republican. And what Rush Limbaugh labeled this as, and, Limbaugh is not necessarily a thought leader, but he often reflects the view of sort of the Trumpian base, at least. He's like, these are the establishment Republicans cracking up as President Trump and Steve Bannon and the base is winning.
My question, though, one, does it really change anything about the math for the midterms? And two, what does this mean for possible tax reform? Let's just talk about the status of potential tax reform. There's movement on
the budget
this measure.
Week with the
what
budget, which allows them to overhaul the tax code with just 50 votes instead of 60.
That is significant. It's this process called reconciliation, which for those at
home.
You're
smiling as you say it. You're geeking out right now. I love it.
For those at home who are following the efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, that was the same process that they used for that. It's sort of a budget trick that allows the Senate to sort of bypass the filibuster. But
doing it that way with reconciliation, it makes it easier on the GOP because they need fewer votes. But it also makes it harder because there are budget rules that say basically when you do it this way, through reconciliation, some of these new tax cuts have to be paid for, which is why you're hearing these conversations this week about doing things like paring down deductions and 401k contributions and loopholes.
And one man's loophole is another man's very important fair part of
yes.
the tax code.
The challenge with simplifying the tax code is that all of these changes that have been added over the years are the result of intense lobbying by some interest group. Mm-hmm. And whenever you try to strip out those benefits and those loopholes, some interest group that is spending a lot of money to fund the campaign of some lawmaker is going to say, don't you dare let this happen.
And not to mention, like, some large number of voters who are like, hey, wait a second.
I like that deduction. I'm not even going to ask you guys to predict what happens with this thing because we don't know.
We don't know at
but
all.
But this rhetoric that, like, this is the GOP's last chance to do something, do we believe that? I think if they don't get this, they'll try something else.
But in President Trump's first year, I mean, at first the deadline was in the first 100 days.
Yep.
Now we're talking about in the first year. Mm-hmm. They've tried and failed to pass a lot of big legislation. I do think this is the last chance in his first year. Now, whether that arbitrary number makes any difference is debatable.
The problem with his second year is that that is a midterm election year. That mm-hmm. is a year when every single House seat is up for re-election and about a third of the Senate is up for re-election. And so things are harder to do, generally speaking, in election years. Basically, as a president, you are never going to have an easier time getting something done than in the very beginning of your term, especially if you have control of both the House and the Senate, which is what Republicans have right now.
Mm. Ari, before we move on from our main story of the week and get to my fun game, who said that, I want you to talk about your most recent trip. You were in Indonesia for how long?
I was there for 2 weeks doing this big reporting project that is all going to air in 1 week on All Things Considered and with a little stuff online and elsewhere.
Yeah. So Indonesia is an economic powerhouse, a very populated country that no one talks about.
Yeah, it's the fourth largest country in the world, the third largest democracy in the world. It is 85% Muslim, and in its founding documents, pluralism, diversity, and coexistence are the basis for this country's identity. I mean, people generally know that Indonesia is a Muslim country. There are more Muslims in Indonesia than in the entire Middle East combined.
I had no
idea.
Yes.
I had no idea.
Yes. And this is a country that celebrates pluralism and diversity. And so I went there to look at what holds this country of 17,000 islands together.
What is it?
Well, so there are many, many different answers. But one is that this founding idea of the word is Pancasila, which is sort of like it doesn't matter how you worship God as long as you worship God, and these other ideas of coexistence and diversity. Yeah. So I did lots of different stories about religious tensions. I have a profile of this young female stand-up comedian who comes from a conservative Muslim family and wears a hijab. I met a food blogger. I mean, the other thing about Indonesia is that a food blogger, the median age in Indonesia is 10 years younger than China or the United States. So this is a really young country. So there are like 700 languages spoken in Indonesia.
Wow.
Here's one fun fact. Even though almost everybody in the country speaks Indonesian, 93% of people do not speak it as their first language.
Wow.
So imagine if like 93% of Americans grew up speaking a language other than English, and then everybody learned English to go to school and do business.
Can Indonesia's success on that front, achieving unity with lots of different types of people, is that the new normal for the rest of the world at some point soon? And what can we learn from that?
So this is the question that I'm exploring, right? Like, what can the United States and other countries learn from Indonesia? One analyst that I spoke to said Indonesia is basically like a swing state in the region. And everybody's trying to exert influence, and there are worrisome trends and tensions, and people are saying, oh, is there a conservative creep in society, or is this just the push-pull of any democracy? These are all the issues that I'm exploring.
And is it an unqualified success story, or are there real tensions?
There are real tensions. Yeah. And look, this country has only been a country as we know it with a democratic system and since like the 90s.
Huh.
So it's still
since
young.
Janet Jackson was hot.
Well, she's still
well
you take that
played,
back.
Cam. Well
I think she's swell. Janet, if you're listening, I support you and I affirm you.
I mean hot
I
on the charts. Hot on the charts.
I hope Janet is listening. Janet, if you're listening, we want to have you on the show.
Yeah, we do.
Give us a call.
Yeah, we do. Ari, folks can hear your stories beginning next week on All Things Considered.
Yes,
all week long. I love it. All right.
And we went with a photographer, Claire Harbage, who took some extraordinary, beautiful images that are going to be on NPR.org.
I bet you Janet's really big in Indonesia.
I bet she is.
I bet she is.
Why not?
You know, for whatever reason, American 90s rock is so big in Indonesia.
Wait, which part of the 90s?
Pearl Jam.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it okay?
Yeah, it's okay.
I never saw it for Pearl Jam.
Well, Sam, that is the difference between you and me summed up perfectly.
I like, was it Jeremy?
Yeah, that
I'm not
going to
do my Jeremy voice.
Oh, my God. Jeremy spoke in class. Oh, yeah. That's a throwback.
I'm not doing it. I'm
you just did it.
Jeremy spoke.
Wow.
And that video was really sad.
Yeah. Oh, I spent so much time thinking about that video and analyzing it as a young person.
It was dark. All right, time for one more quick break. When we come back, we'll play my favorite game, Who Said That? And we'll hear our listeners tell us the best things of their week.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour. And if you're looking for a new podcast, check out the TED Radio Hour. Every week, we explore what it means to be human. We go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, insights, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. You can find it on the NPR One app or however you get your podcasts.
If you're a business owner, you know these sounds mean sales. And from the sound of it, your business is growing. Whether you're fulfilling orders from your home office or warehouse, Stamps.com helps you stress less about mailing and shipping and spend more time doing what you love most. Listening to ASMR. I mean, growing your business. But as you grow, so does the need for efficiency. Stamps.com simplifies your shipping and mailing process. Import orders from wherever you sell online. Find the lowest rates with the fastest delivery times. Instantly deliver tracking updates to your customers. And buy shipping and mailing supplies when you run low. Save time and money on mailing and shipping. Get started at Stamps.com today with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale.
We are back. It is time for my favorite game.
Ooh,
Who said that?
Wherein you make your guests look kind of dumb. Let's do it!
Y'all are going to do well this week, I believe in my heart. Disclaimer before we start. As you guys know, the winner gets absolutely nothing.
Okay. Perfect.
Great. Okay.
Great.
All right.
High stakes.
You know, there. So someone on Twitter who follows the show, she commented recently that
Janet Jackson?
Yeah.
If you're nasty.
And even if you're not, listen to the show. But they said for the first time like ever we had panelists get all three right. It rarely happens. I think it's only happened once.
If it's only happened once, maybe you should make them a little bit easier, Mr. Sanders.
I like a good challenge. You guys got this. First quote, "We will wait every local paper out and let them continuously bleed until we are the last one standing." Who said that?
I know this.
It's like the publisher of the sports website
it's a new
that's
sports
trying
website.
To destroy.
Oh.
Close enough. You both win. it's this startup site called The Athletic. That sentence was uttered by Alex Mather, one of the co-founders of The Athletic. The Athletic is this new subscription sports journalism startup. Basically, their goal is to hire all the local sports writers and have them work for The Athletic. And they said that their business model is to basically, like, put local sports pages out of business.
And then he had to apologize
on the
for
same
sounding
day.
Like such a jerk.
On the same day, he had to apologize.
Imagine the head of a tech startup sounding like a jerk.
What? He said, quote, "I'm truly sorry for the tone of my comment in the New York Times. I learned a lesson in humility that will help me grow as a leader."
No, I think what he learned a lesson in was how to speak on the record as though you're a more benevolent person than you actually
are. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Everyone like forgets that journalists are writing this stuff down. When you call us, we're recording, we're writing, we're taking notes. Anyway, next quote. Ready? "They decided to use our vessel to teach their children how to hunt. They attacked at night."
Oh, Russians on Twitter.
Ari's got the fire today.
Oh.
"They decided to use our vessel to teach their children how to hunt. They attacked at night."
Raccoons?
Even worse, sharks.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what?
This was
that is dark.
Jennifer Appel. She's an American woman who was sailing from Hawaii to Tahiti with another woman, Tasha Fuyafa.
Oh, they were just rescued after like 5 months.
They were
right?
stuck in the water 5 months, and sharks circled their boat trying to eat them.
Oh, and there were two dogs on boat on the boat too. They had enough food to survive that whole time.
They were on a 50-foot sailboat. They suffered engine failure and a broken mast in a storm, and they drifted for 5,000 miles. They were rescued this week, 5 months stranded, surrounded by sharks in the Pacific Ocean.
That idea of being attacked at night, teaching that. Oh.
She said that the sharks would come by to slap their tails, which would tell them that it was time to move along. They survived because they had water purifiers and a year's supply of dry food. They made distress calls for 98 straight days. Lord goodness.
Oh.
Glad they're safe.
Yeah.
Sharks are scary.
I have never had a desire to sail the world.
I don't really get on
Me
boats.
Me neither.
I don't really get on boats.
Yeah.
I enjoy a boat if somebody who knows what they're doing is in charge of the boat.
Yeah.
They probably know what they're doing, though. That's
yeah,
the wild
yeah, well, clearly, because they survived for 5 months at sea.
Last quote. The quote is, we'd be like, dance, pose, dance, butt slap, pose.
Is this like a K-pop artist?
One more quote that might help is this. The genius of Tom Hanks to do that finger point. We did not tell
David,
him to
David S. Pumpkins, the oral history.
Yes.
This week, there was a big, long oral history of the SNL David S. Pumpkins skit. It was in Vulture this week. So those quotes were from SNL writer Street Seidel and SNL cast member Mikey Day. Mikey Day and Bobby Moynihan were in this David S. Pumpkins skit with Tom Hanks, which is infamous and classic. There's also a new David Pumpkins Halloween special on NBC this weekend. It's animated. I'm not going to watch that, even though I love David S. Pumpkins.
No,
I'm not watching that.
I'm going to stick to Charlie Brown.
It was a great skit, though. What are you guys doing for Halloween?
I was just going to say, are you going to be David S. Pumpkins
for
Halloween?
I'm on the fence for buying one of the suits. They're fairly expensive.
Mm.
Really?
That's like stupid. $60, $70 for a suit that I will wear once and only once.
Right.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to take my kid trick-or-treating.
What's he going to be?
He is Iron Man this year.
Aww.
What I love is that these kids' costumes have these incredible muscles. So you have this like skinny little five-year-old with these big muscles.
Cute.
Bring pictures.
I will.
What about you, Ari?
So I sometimes perform with a band called Pink Martini.
Yes, you do.
And we have 3 nights at the Kennedy Center with the National Symphony.
Oh, wow.
So that's what I'm doing.
On Halloween?
No, it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday. On the actual Halloween, I will be hosting All Things Considered.
Wear a costume while you host. All right, Tam. All right, we're almost done. I promise. You're like, I thought we were done.
No, I wanted to keep going.
It'll keep going forever in our hearts. First, though, I want to plug Tuesday's episode of the podcast. I talked to an author you guys have probably heard of, Daniel Alarcón.
Oh yeah.
He hosts an NPR podcast as well called Radio Ambulante.
But, NPR's first Spanish language podcast.
Yeah, and it's really good. But I talked to him about his new book. It is called The King is Always Above the People. It's a collection of 10 fiction short stories, and it's riveting. And it's a heavy, emotional piece of work that really outlines some big ideas about what it means to be Latino, what it means to be an immigrant, what it means to move somewhere else. And those kind of themes, I think, are really timely right now in a time in which we're having conversations about walls and who gets to stay. And so this book of fiction ends up telling some really interesting truths about some of our politics today. And I love the conversation.
Cool.
And Daniel was really smart and thoughtful, and I think folks will like it. Listen to that on Tuesday.
Awesome.
With that, we're going to end the weekly wrap as we always do. Each week, we ask our listeners to send us a recording of them sharing the best thing that happened to them all week. We encourage them to brag. Brent puts it all together for us. Let's take a listen now.
Hey, Sam, this is Esteban from Houston, Texas, and the best thing that happened to me all week was fixing my girlfriend's car. She was having steering column issues that would have cost her over $400 at the shop, but after buying some parts and doing some YouTube research, I was able to do the repairs myself safely, and now her car runs like new again.
Wow, that's a good boyfriend.
Yeah.
And when I was done, the smile and the kiss that she gave me just made me feel amazing.
Esteban for the win.
Hey, Sam. This is Christine from Bulgaria. The best thing that happened to me all week was that my mom called me to say good morning some of the days.
Huh.
Hey, Sam. This is Tom from Roanoke, Virginia. The best part of my week is that my wife and I are sitting outside of the doctor's office, and we just found out that our little bean that's due in March is a little boy.
Hi, Sam. This is Megan calling from Akron, Ohio. And the best thing that happened to me this week is I got to celebrate my 33rd birthday with 5 girls I've known for over 15 years.
Yeah.
We spent the weekend recreating the sleepovers we used to have in high school, complete with ice cream and yearbooks and the same old stories we've all heard a million times.
That sounds like fun.
That's great.
Hey, Sam. Great. It's Nicole from Dallas. And the best part of my week was watching the Astros make it to the World Series.
Good job,
my
Astros.
My dad was calling me from Houston at 11 p.m. while I was sitting in a bar, just so excited. The Astros finally made it. It's been 12 years.
Hi, Sam.
Hi.
It's April from Tuskegee, and the best thing that's happening to me all week is that it is Tuskegee's homecoming, so T-U, you know. So the best part about this homecoming is that we have an alumni choir rehearsal where people from as far back as the 1930s and 40s come back, and we just sing.
That's
pretty
amazing.
Much have a jam session.
That sounds real
from
fun.
All the songs that we sung with, and we hear their stories, and it is my favorite day of the year.
All right.
Just wanted to let you all know that it is homecoming, so y'all send us your well wishes.
I'm doing it right now, April.
So 2 weeks ago, I reached out for some help after finally realizing that it wasn't just new mom blues this last year. There's something more going on. And I thought that the best thing that had happened to me all week was that I'm finally starting to feel like myself again.
Oh, that's good. Mm.
But then today, my son took his first steps just in time for his dad to see before he leaves for deployment.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And I think that might have taken the cake.
Yeah.
Have a good weekend.
That is a week.
A lot in there.
Love your podcast. Keep up the great work.
Have a great weekend. Bye.
Thanks to all of those listeners that sent us the sound of their voices. Esteban, best boyfriend ever. Elizabeth, Christine, Tom, Megan, Nicole, April, who actually we called on the show a while back. She was a long-distance call. She's so fun. Enjoy homecoming, April. We listen to all of these that come in. We get a lot. They warm our hearts all week, every week. We wish we had time to play all of them. We don't. But know that when you hit send on those emails, it lands in the show inbox, and we do hear it. So thank you all for sharing those. Also, Nicole mentioned the World Series. Shout out to folks rooting for a team, either team, whichever team you like. As a Texan, I support the Astros. But as someone who thinks that Dodger Stadium is beautiful, I support the Dodgers, too.
You can't
and Dodger dogs are great. You don't like the Dodger dog?
They're fine.
I like the Dodger dog.
I just love the view of the palm trees and the sunset from Dodger Stadium.
All that.
It's a beautiful thing. Go sports ball. It's something worth watching. if you want to share your best thing all week, you can do so at any time throughout the week. Just record yourself and email the file to samsanders@npr.org. With that, Mama, we made it. Janet, take
more
us home.
Janet.
More Janet. Never enough
more Janet.
Janet. This week, the show was edited by Jeff Rogers and Steve Nelson. Our big boss, the VP of programming here at NPR, is Anya Grundman. The show is produced by Brent Bachman and Anjali Sastry. Refresh your feed Tuesday morning for my chat with Daniel Alarcon. Tam, Ari, you're two all-stars. Thank you all.
Thank you,
Let's
Sam.
Leave
this
the
is like a giant hug.
Hugs to Janet. Hugs to Janet. All right, thanks for listening. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the Indicator podcast in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news like...
How does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money and NPR. When the economic news gets to be a bit much...
Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money. We're here for you, like your friends, trying to figure out all the most confusing parts. One story, one idea, every day, all in 10 minutes or less.
The Indicator from Planet Money, your friendly economic sidekick.
From NPR.